The talk you are about to hear is by Sensei Richard von Stürmer. So our teisho is on Hakuin Yasutani Roshi. In September last year, I began a Dharma Ancestors series, and I gave a teisho on Harada Sogaku Roshi, who Philip Kaplow trained with for 3 years at Hoshinji in Japan. Hakuin Yasutani Roshi was a Dharma heir of Harada Roshi and Roshi Kaplow's second main teacher. And Yasutani's one of our great grandfathers in the Dharma for people at the Auckland Zen Center. His dates are 1885 to 1973. When he left Hoshinji, Philip Kaplow stayed in Japan, and after some 20 sesshins, and he did many, many sesshins with Harada Roshi, but after 20 sesshins with Yasutani Roshi, he finally passed Mu and began to work through the koan curriculum with Yasutani. And during this time, they formed a very deep student-teacher relationship. Yasutani Roshi ordained Philip Kaplow as a Zen priest in 1958. And Philip Kaplow became Yasutani Roshi's translator when he gave Doksan to Western students. Yasutani Roshi spoke no English. He was also instrumental in bringing Yasutani Roshi to the States in the early 1960s and making his teachings available to Westerners via the Three Pillars of Zen. So Yasutani Roshi is a key figure in the transmission of Zen to the West. The three groups in New Zealand with Japanese roots, the Diamond Sangha, the Mountains and Rivers Order, and the Auckland Zen Center, all have Yasutani Roshi as their Dharma ancestor. And in addition to Philip Kaplow, Yasutani Roshi was a principal teacher of both Aiken Roshi and Mayazumi Roshi. And so for a little bit of background, biographical background, I'll read from Flowers Fall, a commentary on Zen Master Dogen's Gincho Koan, the only real main book of Yasutani Roshi's writings is in English. It's by Paul Jaffe. So, at his birth, there's a miraculous story about his birth. His mother had already decided that her next son would be a priest when she was given a bead of a rosary by a nun who instructed her to swallow it for a safe childbirth. When he was born, his left hand was tightly clasped around the same bead. By his own reckoning, your life flows out of time much earlier than what begins at your own conception. Your life seeks your parents. It is as if I jumped right into the situation while I was still in her womb with my mother contemplating my priesthood. When he studied biology in school, the story seemed ridiculous, but he later wrote, "Now, practicing the Buddha way more and more, understanding many more channels of the Buddha way, I realized it is not so strange, but quite natural. My mother wanted me to become a priest, and because I was conceived in that wish, and because I too desired the priesthood, the rosary bead expressed that karma relation." His family were extremely poor, and at the age of 5, he was sent to a country temple near Numatsu City. In fact, In fact, we have a story just previous to that, in his own words, that was published in the Zen Center of Los Angeles Journal, a commemorative edition for Yasunori Roshi. This is what he says. I was told many times, as early as I can remember in my childhood, when you grow up, you will become a priest. And each time I was told, I nodded, yes. When at the age of 4, my mother left me at a temple without telling me why, I didn't understand at all. But one thing I vaguely remember was the desire to get back home and trying all kinds of tricks to accomplish that. After my mother disappeared, I wouldn't eat or talk. It annoyed everyone at the temple that they had to take care of me. They tried to feed me, but didn't succeed. No matter what they said, I wouldn't speak a word. So even at that age, 4, sort of shows Yasutani's stubborn nature. They were patient with me for a few days, but when their patience wore off, they called my mother to take me back. My mother came and put me on her back, then carried me out of the temple to the public road. As I was told later, at that point, I started singing. A year later, I returned to the temple, and this time I understood why. A nun came to our home. You've always said you wanted to be a priest, I was told. So, this nun has come to take you as her pupil. Will you go with her? I said, yes, and went. But we can only imagine, especially as a 4-year-old, the trauma Yasutani must have experienced being abandoned by his mother the first time at a temple, how that must have affected him as he grew up. Going back to Jaffe's account. When he studied, he had his head shaved when he was 5, and he was educated by the abbot of the temple, Suyama Genpo. His training at this time was very strict and meticulous, but also very loving, and left a deep impression on him throughout his life. At the age of 11, he moved to a nearby temple, Daishuji, which, like Fukuju, belonged to the Rinzai sect. After a fight with an older student, however, he was forced to leave. There we have a sort of little inkling of Yasutani Roshi's combative nature that would come to the fore as he grew up. When later he was placed in another temple, this time one of the Soto sect, and it was here that he became a monk of the Soto sect and the priest Yasutani Ryogi, from whom he took his name. Through his 20s and 30s, Yasutani Roshi continued his training with several other Buddhist priests. He also furthered his education, going to teacher training school, and then beginning a 10-year career as an elementary teacher, school teacher, and principal. At the age of 30, he married and raised a family which produced 5 children. This is in contrast to his teacher, Harada Roshi, who was a celibate priest. In 1925, at the age of 40, he returned to his vocation as a Buddhist priest. Soon after, he was appointed as a specially dispatched priest for the propagation of the Soto sect, traveling around giving lectures. However, he wrote in 1952, I was altogether a blind fellow, and my mind was not at rest. I was at a peak of mental anguish. When I felt I could not endure deceiving myself and others by untrue teaching and irresponsible sermons any longer, my karma opened up and I was able to meet my master, Daion Harada Sogaku Roshi. The light of a lantern was brought to the dark night, to my profound joy. Yasutani Roshi set his first sesshin with the Radha Roshi in 1925, and 2 years later, at the age of 42, was recognized as having attained Kensho, awakening to his true nature. Some 10 years later, he finished his koan study, and then, at the age of 58, received Dharma transmission from Harada Roshi in 1943. Yasutani Roshi's career as a Zen teacher was devoted and single-minded. He was the head of a training hall for monks for a short while, but gave it up and applied his efforts primarily towards the training of lay practitioners. His years leading a family life and working as an educator no doubt both influenced him in his direction and prepared him for the task. During the next 30 years, he held over 300 sesshins, led numerous regular Zazen meetings, and lectured widely. In addition, he published almost 100 volumes of writing. In 1954, he split with the Soto school and he founded the Sambo Kyodan, the Three Treasures. So he founded his own school separate from the Soto school, and that's continuing his own teacher's teaching of integrated Zen, which we're part of, mixing both elements of Rinzai and Soto Zen. Already in his late 70s, Yasutani Roshi first traveled to the United States in 1962. He held sesshin in over half a dozen cities and, due to an enthusiastic response, made 6 more visits, continuing through 1969. And this mentioning the influence that he has on leading Zen teachers in America today. Just a little bit about his death from the Los Angeles Zen Center's journal. Yasutani Roshi was writing, seeing his students, and conducting ceremonies right until the end. On Sunday, March 25th, 1973, he gave Jukai to 12 people, including Robert and Ann Aiken. This was in Japan. Afterwards, he said that the day's Jukai would be his last, that he had done it on willpower alone. Then, on Wednesday, March 28, after several days of coughing and shortness of breath, he sat cross-legged in his bed while his breakfast of rice gruel was being prepared. He told his daughter, Cheiko, that he would like to wash his face. She left to bring a hot towel. When she returned, she found that he had passed away. And physically, Yasutani Roshi was quite striking in appearance. He was very thin and very small, with bat-like ears and very fierce eyes. Robert Aiken remembers that when he gave a teisho on Gute's finger, that's shi chi in Chinese, instead of holding up a forefinger, he would raise an incredibly long thumb. The koan, Gute's fingers, just very quickly, Gute had an attendant. Gute's main teaching was to raise up a finger. And Gute had an attendant who would often copy his master and raise up his finger. So one day, he asked his young attendant, a question. And the attendant held up his finger and Gute chopped it off. So the story goes, and as the attendant was going out wailing, Gute called him. The attendant looked back, and Gute raised his finger, and the boy was enlightened. That's how the story goes. Aiken describes Yasutani as like a feather, but still full of passion and having a ready laugh. And while Roshi and I were training in Rochester, we talked about him with Audrey Fernandez, a founding member of the Rochester Zen Center. She said that when Yasutani came into a room, it was like a fine mist entering. Our teacher, Bodhin Roshi, writes, "When I came to see Yasutani Roshi as more than a little rigid and authoritarian, a kind of Zen fundamentalist, I described this impression of him to Roshi Kaplow. It surprised me to hear that he'd always found Yasutani Roshi to be gentle, soft-spoken, and laid back, in contrast to his first teacher, Harada Sogaki Roshi." So there's the paradox with Yasutani Roshi. Along with his lightness and gentleness, there was his fiery, intemperate nature and his fiery words at times, often directed at the Soto school. In his 80s, Yasutani published commentaries on the Mumonkan, the Hekigan Roku, and the Shoyoroku, the three main collections of koans. And Ken Kraft, a professor of Japanese studies and a member of the Rochester Zen Center, was asked why these would have never been translated into English, these commentaries. And he said, well, it was problematic. They were problematic in that they were peppered. The texts were peppered with diatribes against the Soto establishment and their ignoring of the importance of Kensho awakening. Aiken Roshi writes, Yasutani was criticized for his emphasis on Kensho, seeing into one's true nature. But Aiken Roshi writes, "I think that Yasutani Roshi's hope was that people could get a start when they had an opening into their koan, and that with that start, they could deepen and clarify that insight through subsequent study of koans, other koans. I think that Yasutani placed less emphasis on Kensho than people who are criticizing him, because the people who are criticizing him are regarding Kensho as some sort of be-all and end-all. And he didn't look at that in that way at all." I think that's an important point. Sometimes initial opening, passing one's koan, can seem shallow, although there's changes going on, and that insight is gradually can expand as you grapple with other koans in the koan curriculum. And that's why studying of going through the Mumonkan and the other collections are so important for students who do work on koans. Now, there's a dark side to Yasutani Roshi's past that came to light in Brian Victoria's book, Zen at War, which was published in 1997. Like his teacher, Harada Roshi, Yasutani Roshi was vocal in his support of the emperor and the Japanese military government during World War II. In step with the military propaganda of the time, he saw Japan as the liberator of Southeast Asia. The enemies were the Allies, and especially the United States. In order to establish a pure land on earth, his words, he approved and wrote about the necessity of killing the enemy. This is of course, is a real distortion of the first precept, not to kill, but to cherish all life. He was said in texts that was for the greater good, spreading of the Japanese rule that these killings took place. And such was the jingoistic climate at the time in Japan that only a handful of Japanese spoke out against the war and they were jailed. Eiken Roshi writes that until the end of World War II, Japanese subjects were clearly Japanese first and Buddhist second. They understood the will of the emperor to be their karma. And this was the case, unfortunately, of Yasutani Roshi. All this emperor worship and empire building fell apart when the Japanese government surrendered at the end of World War II. Tangen Roshi, who was, as a young monk, who was Roshi Kaplow's mentor at Hoshinji, and a great teacher, Roshi and I have given Teisho's, a series of Teisho's recently on Tangen Roshi. And he said that as a young man during World War II, he also held the view that the emperor was God and supported the military regime, hoping to die for Japan. He says, "We believed that Americans were devils and that saving the Mahayana was up to us. After the war, we discovered that we'd been completely duped, so we changed our views." He believed that both Harada Roshi and Yasutani Roshi's wholehearted support for their Western students was part of their repayment for previous wrongdoings. So people change and teachers change. It's important to bear in mind. Now, a note on Brian Victoria, who is an American Soto priest. In the early 1990s, he was a lecturer of Asian studies at Auckland University. At the time, Roshi and I were part of the Auckland Zen Group, which was an umbrella group. We'd meet once a week and we'd get together to sit. And there were people in the group from all different lineages, us from the Rochester Zen Center, Jim Mon and others from Zen Mountain Monastery. There was a student of Joko Beck, student of Tony Packer. So it was really an amalgamation of different people with following different teachers. But we got on, more or less. So when we learned from an article that here was this American priest, Soto priest, in Auckland, well, we thought we'd get in contact with him. And I think it was Jim Mon who rang him up at university and invited him to sit with our group and maybe if he felt he liked, give us a little lecture, get a talk. And he got a very cold no. And that was it. And that surprised it at the time. However, after the publication of Zen at War, it became clear that he had an aversion to Western Zen groups and that we were, the Auckland Zen Group, in his words at the end of Zen at War, modern day variations of imperial way and soldier way Zen. And this is clearly untrue and extremely misleading. Eiken Roshi was the founder of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, a very important fellowship in America, with different Buddhist teachers and students working for peace. Roshi Kaplow was outspoken about the war in Vietnam, and John Daidalori from Zen Monastery was just as outspoken about the Second Gulf War. And the statement of Victoria also flies in the face of the fact that roughly half the Zen teachers in the West are female, and none of them would have a bone of military samurai-style Zen. So I think we can really take Brian Victoria to task with that statement, which he refused. Eiken Roshi, on several occasions, asked him to remove it from republications of Zen at War, but he refused. So I think there's a real puritanical zeal behind Brian Victoria. And he often takes his passages of missayings by Japanese Zen teachers out of context. Then, in 1999, Tricycle magazine published a feature, Yasutani Roshi, The Hardest Koan. And it begins with an essay by Brian Victoria, who had unearthed a book on Dogen, in Japanese, of course, which Yasutani wrote in 1943, during World War II. And he quotes passages in the book which highlighted Yasutani Roshi's fervent nationalism and anti-Semitism. The Tricycle feature then published responses to Brian Victoria's material by people with a connection to Yasutani lineages in the United States, including Aiken Roshi and our teacher, Bodhin Roshi. I'll just read two of the three or more passages that Brian Victoria quotes, Yasutani on the Jews. In this publication, Yasutani wrote, "Everyone should act according to their position in society. Those who are in a superior position should take pity on those below. Those who are below should revere those who are above. Men should fulfill the way of men, while women observe the way of woman, making absolutely sure that there is not the slightest confusion between their respective roles." This sort of rings a bell today with hardline Republican views. Anyway, he goes on. "It is therefore necessary to thoroughly defeat the propaganda and strategy of the Jews. That is to say, we must clearly point out the fallacy of their evil ideas, advocating freedom and equality, ideas that have dominated the world up to the present day." Then another passage. "Beginning in the Meiji period, perhaps because Japan was so busy importing Western material civilization, our precious Japanese Buddhism was discarded without a second thought. For this reason, Japanese Buddhism fell into a situation in which it was half dead and half alive, leaving Japanese education without a soul. The result was almost total loss of the spirit of Japan, for the general citizenry became fascinated with the ideas of freedom and equality as advocated by the scheming Jews, not to mention such things as individualism, money or might as almighty, and pleasure seeking." Okay, so we can really take our great-grandfather to task for making such comments. But at the time, there were scarcely any Jews in Japan. And Japan had little or no history of anti-Semitism in contrast to European countries. And Yasutani was basically parroting the racist views of Japan's Nazi allies. At the time, Aiken Roshi gives a very cogent response to this. Okay, this is Aiken Roshi's written response in the same Tricycle article. "Yasutani Roshi spoke out vehemently against the Jews, but as Victoria notes, Japanese anti-Semitism has always been superficial. It had been a putrid flower with shallow roots, springing from a cultural aversion to the notions of individual freedom and social equality, rather than from a grotesque, age-old rationale that ignited European pogroms. It was delusive, nonetheless, and I regret that my old teacher allowed himself to be caught up in it. Apparently, his views changed, for in the 1960s, he accepted students who had Jewish antecedents, which they freely acknowledged. One of them, Paul Weinpaal, gives an endearing account of his study with Yasutani Roshi in his book, Zen Diaries. Okay, so yeah, I think that's a good metaphor that Yasutani's views on anti-Semitic Jews can be seen as a putrid flower with shallow roots. And of course, among Yasutani's American students was Philip Kaplow, whose mother was Jewish, and Bernie Glassman, Roshi, who was Jewish and also worked with Yasutani Roshi. And he writes, "As a Jew, I never picked up a hint of bigotry against the West in general or against Jews in particular." So it's important to acknowledge these strongly held views that Yasutani Roshi did have during World War II. But he went ahead and devoted himself tirelessly towards the end of his life to his Western students. And then in the tricycle feature, Bowden Roshi, our teacher, sums up the anti-war jingoism of Yasutani. And this is what he says. "They took over half a century to reach us, but the revelations about Yasutani Roshi, like a long-range missile launched from the other side of the world, have hit the Western Zen community hard." Again, this is back in 1999. "The chief casualty, the enlightened person. Good riddance. Maybe now we can get out of his or her shadow and see that there's never been an enlightened person. There are only enlightened activities. That is, activities or words that reflect a direct experience of the non-dual nature of reality. So let us reject the politics of Yasutani Roshi and commit ourselves to the timeless, universal practice to which he devoted his life." The other matter that we have to address with Yasutani Roshi is his split with his first Western student, and our grandfather in the Dharma, Philip Kaplow, who became Roshi Philip Kaplow. And in 1967, there was a dramatic split between them. Philip Kaplow had been given permission to teach and had established the Rochester Zen Center in 1966. And he'd monitored two Yasutani-led sesshins with Taisan, Yasutani Roshi's assistant. And a third was being planned. And the cause of the split was painful and had repercussions for the Rochester Zen Center. Philip Kaplow withdrew from being a student of Yasutani Roshi. And he was still in the midst of his koan studies and had not received Inca Dharma transmission from Yasutani Roshi, which meant that the Rochester Zen Center was not formally affiliated with the Japanese lineage, and they had to sort of go alone. They were sort of out in the cold as far as official ties, links with Japan. And at that meeting, which was in Rochester, Audrey Fernandez attended. And Roshi Kaplow never really spoke about the split. He wrote a brief sentence or two at the end of his merging of East and West, his follow-up to the Three Pillars of Zen. But the bottom line is that we don't know. We don't know what caused the split. And Audrey, who was present at the time, she didn't speak or understand Japanese. But she told us, we're in Rochester, pump Audrey for stories of the olden days at the Zen Center. And she said that when she was up with Philip Kaplow and Yasutani Roshi in a room upstairs, there was a full-length mirror in the room. And she made sure that she didn't look in the mirror during the meeting, because Yasutani Roshi would see that and consider her a vain woman. So that's all we got from Audrey, that she didn't look in the full-length mirror. However, there are three probable causes for the split, and I'd just like to go into them briefly. This is what we got when we were at the Rochester Zen Center, that Yasutani Roshi was strongly opposed to the Rochester Zen Center's translation of the Heart Sutra into English, even though it had been translated into Chinese, Korean, and Tibetan. He wanted the Heart Sutra to remain in Sino-Japanese. But Philip Kaplow decided that it should be an English translation so that the teaching, the wonderful teaching of the Heart Sutra, would be accessible to his students. And we've chanted it tonight. And the Rochester Zen Center was the first to have an English translation of American centers. And then soon after, others followed suit. That's one cause. The second possible cause was Philip Kaplow's doubts about Taisan, Yasutani Roshi's assistant, and his reluctance to keep working with him. And I discussed Taisan became Edo Roshi and founded Daibusatsu Monastery in the Catskills. Taisan, at that stage, had a history of preying on women students. And I've addressed that history in my two-part talk, Zen and Character. So I won't go into that now. So Philip Kaplow, at that stage, was aware of Taisan's character faults. However, the odd thing is that in 1972, Taisan received Dharma transmission from Soen Nakagawa Roshi, and he was invited to be a guest at the opening of the Buddha Hall at the Rochester Zen Center in 1973. So it sort of raises the question, why Philip Kaplow, Roshi Kaplow, was so opposed to Taisan, why did he invite him as a guest to the opening of the Buddha Hall? Again, we don't know. And the third possible cause was their conflicting views on the Vietnam War, which was raging at the time. Yasutani Roshi was vehemently for the war in Vietnam, and Philip Kaplow was outspokenly against it. And there was a student of Yasutani Roshi in New York, Hugh Curran, who acted as a go-between between teacher and student. And he reported to our teacher that this was the main cause of their split, was their strong feelings about the Vietnam War. Whatever the cause, and I think this is an important point, whatever the cause, wanting to make the Heart Sutra accessible to Western students, not wanting to work with a deeply flawed Taisan, or opposing the Vietnam War, I believe that Philip Kaplow showed real integrity on all counts. And to finish up, I'd like to read from some of Yasutani's writings. This is from a little booklet, early booklet, Eight Beliefs in Buddhism. He writes, "All existences are perfect as they are. This perfection is demonstrated as a circle. The leg of a crane is long and is perfect in its length, whereas the duck's leg is short and is perfect in its shortness. Perfection does not mean that we should try to shorten the crane's leg or lengthen the duck's leg in order to make each of them conform to our preconceived notion of a more pleasing appearance. The real meaning of perfection is that all things are perfect just as they are. The elephant is perfect as it is. The ant, although small, is perfect as it is. An ant cannot do things which an elephant can do, but neither can an elephant do things which ants can do. There is no reason for a wealthy person to be haughty because they are wealthy, nor is any reason for a poor person to feel inferior. Both are perfect as they are." Then further on, he writes, "When one likes alcohol, they find themselves in the company of drunkards. If one is addicted to gambling, they find themselves associating with gamblers. Those who do zazen are attracted to others who do zazen. And if one studies Buddhism, they will be in touch with many students whose interest is the same. The attraction exists between human beings and animals as well. Dogs take kindly to people who like dogs. The same is true with cats. In fact, since animals' minds are simpler, freer from delusion, they are naturally more sensitive and intuitive." Then he tells a following Chinese story, which has always stayed with me. Once there was a boy who went out in the ocean in his boat every day to play with the seagulls. His father noticed this and said to him, "I know that you go out in the ocean to be with the seagulls. Please catch one of them for me tomorrow." The boy replied to his father, "If you want to have one, I will do it for you." But the next day, when he went out in the boat, as usual, there were no seagulls anywhere about. And Yasutani comments, "We can understand the story only if we believe that the seagulls sense the boy's intention to capture one of them." And finally, from Flowers Fall, a comment on Dogen's, "To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the myriad dharmas." Yasutani writes, "To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self, what must one endeavor to do? What is essential is to throw away one's own views of oneself, to throw away all one's acquired affectations, which are knowledge and experience accumulated since birth, to become a pure white sheet of paper, and to bring oneself into accord with the teachings of the Buddhas and ancestors. That's the important thing. While carrying around such things as my ideas and my opinions, one absolutely cannot attain the Buddha way. The Buddha way is the way of returning to one's intrinsic nature itself. How can one awaken to one's intrinsic nature when one is deluded by acquired affectations? To forget oneself is not to fall victim to amnesia. It is to throw away all former knowledge and views to become a pure white sheet of paper. That's to forget oneself. Dogen is referring to the state in which one has forgotten oneself when he says, to forget the self is to be enlightened by the myriad dharmas. The myriad dharmas mean all dharmas. All dharmas are everything. Everything is the Buddha way. All dharmas are the Buddha dharma. They are one's intrinsic nature of self. To completely discard one's own views and oneself, and then, moved by one's intrinsic nature itself, to carry out the activities of daily life as one's intrinsic nature, going out and returning home, getting dressed, eating and drinking, defecating and urinating. That is to be enlightened by the myriad dharmas. That is the actualization of enlightenment. The full manifestation of original enlightenment, the full manifestation of absolute nature. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. The teaching you have received is offered freely. If you would like to make a donation to support the continuation of this podcast service or learn more about practice opportunities at the Auckland Zen Centre, please visit www.aucklandzen.org.nz.